Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Adam Glick.
And I'm Craig Box.
So this past week, actually finishing up on Monday of this week, Steam was running their Digital Tabletop Fest. And as many of you know, I enjoy both tabletop games and the digital versions thereof. So it was fun to watch some of those be played. I was wondering if you tuned into any of that, Craig?
No, is a digital tabletop like that old Microsoft Surface?
You know, I've actually played with one of those. And no, it would be more like if you took all those tabletop board games that you have and removed all the pieces and you just had a computer that would set them all up for you, which is like super handy, nice. Of course, during that, I also picked up a new game that I started playing called Simulo, which if you've ever played Dixit or Mysterium, basically it's a two-player cooperative game where you are both working like guess who to try and figure out what is the one card, and one person can give you clues showing you cards and telling you whether the card they're showing you is similar or dissimilar to the one that you're looking for. And so it's a little bit of a logical deduction game, a little bit of an abstract thinking game, just a fun little kind of thing to play. And we were trying that one out.
I think I've played Dixit before, but I did play a lot of Guess Who at high school.
Yep. So think of a mix of the two.
We had a Guess Who board in our homeroom, and we got to the point where basically without any knowledge of computer science or anything, a few classmates and I had invented the concept of binary search. We came to the conclusion that we could ask someone, do you have any accessories? And then cut down exactly half of the board, depending on whether or not they're wearing a hat or a scarf or anything. And very quickly get down to just one candidate. And it got so bad, obviously with nothing else to do in homeroom, but play Guess Who, that we could play an entire game without needing the board. There's only about 30 people on the board, and you can remember all of their characteristics and what you need to do to get down to the end and could play a game without actually looking at them. So put that in your digital tabletop and smoke it. Thank you again to everyone who has filled out our audience survey at kubernetespodcast.com/survey. We've had some great feedback. And if you haven't had a chance yet, there is still time. We're keeping the survey open till November the 10th. So please take a moment and fill it out. It should take no more than 3 minutes, all going well. Let us know what you think of the podcast and how we can continue to make it the best show for the cloud native community.
Let's get to the news.
Last week was the Cloud Foundry Summit in Europe, which was marked by a complete pivot of the platform to Kubernetes. Earlier this year, the Cloud Foundry website introduced the product as an open source cloud application platform, but if you look today, it says it's the proven developer experience for Kubernetes. To that end, the CF for K8s runtime, which lets you install a cloud-native packaged version of Cloud Foundry onto any Kubernetes cluster, has gone 1.0. The Helm-based kubectl runtime released version 2.5, if you want an experience that's more like what you used to run on VMs. The foundation promises that these two packages will continue to converge. To learn more about Cloud Foundry, check out episode 105 with foundation lead Chip Childers.
Microsoft has announced Akri, an open source project for the edge. Essentially, it gives Kubernetes a way to identify and find IoT devices, which Microsoft is calling Leaf devices. Akri's architecture is made up of four key Kubernetes components: two custom resources, a device plugin implementation, and a custom controller. The first custom resource is where you tell Akri the kind of Leaf device you want to discover. Then Akri's agent searches for the availability of your desired Leaf. Once your device has been discovered, the Akri controller deploys a broker pod that knows how to connect to the Leaf and utilizes it. If you're curious to see it in action, there's a demo provided in the announcement.
Contentful has open-sourced their Kube Secret Syncer, an operator that syncs Kubernetes secrets to the AWS Secrets Manager service. This isn't the first secret syncing service, but this one aims to fix the perceived challenges in security, flexibility, and caching in the existing solutions. One of the big changes Contentful claims is that they cache the secrets and only sync when there is an actual change, which can save money versus more frequent syncs. The project is available now, and the creators are interested in any feedback from the community.
A distributed trace takes space, and they accumulate at pace. Race to place them with Tempo, a new open-source tracing backend from Grafana Labs. It is integrated with Loki, Grafana, and Prometheus, while only requiring object storage. Tempo is Jaeger, Zipkin, OpenCensus, and OpenTelemetry compatible. It ingests batches in any of the aforementioned formats, buffers them, and then writes them to Google Cloud Storage, S3, or local disk, which the creators feel makes it robust and inexpensive. Grafana also announced Loki 2.0, with improvements to the query language and transformations now possible across all log content types.
Now you have somewhere to store all those traces, you can update their version, as the OpenTelemetry project has announced a release candidate of the tracing spec. The project now aims to launch matching RC versions of its APIs, SDKs, collector, and auto-instrumentation components, as well as producing a release candidate of the metrics specification.
In case you're observing things running on AWS, they this week announced the AWS distro for OpenTelemetry, a secure and supported distribution of the proceeding. It comes with the connectors required to send telemetry data to AWS CloudWatch metrics, traces, and logs backend, as well as the project's other supported backends.
Amazon has also announced that the Application Load Balancer Ingress Controller is now the AWS Load Balancer Controller. It adds extra features, such as support for using network load balancers with Kubernetes services on Fargate, sharing ALBs with multiple ingress rules, and support for fully private clusters.
The Alibaba and Ant groups have released Nidus, an image service that is an extension of the Dragonfly peer-to-peer container distribution project. Nidus improves on traditional container images, minimizing download times for large containers and providing file integrity checks across the container's lifecycle. At its heart, Nidus is a new container format that uses a user space file system. It addresses many shortcomings of the current OCI V1 spec, and the team says that they were inspired to open source Nidus after seeing how it implemented many features that were being proposed in the upcoming OCI V2.
Robin.io has announced a new free-for-life version of their storage technology called Robin Express. Robin describes itself as a CSI-compliant block storage solution with bare metal performance that seamlessly integrates with Kubernetes administrative tooling. The Express Edition is different from the paid Enterprise Edition in that it doesn't offer 24x7 support, with a limit of 5 nodes and 5 terabytes of storage, but available at no cost. We assume that it's free for the product's life and not yours.
Kubernetes has got so enterprise that you now can buy it from a telco. Verizon Business has launched VNS Application Edge, a hosted Kubernetes add-on to their virtual network services. The service is a white label from Rafi, and promises to bring businesses closer to the edge and make them better able to take advantage of Verizon's 5G network.
And that's the news. David Pate is a site reliability engineer at ad tech company NetCertiv. He is a contributor to the Helm project and currently resides in the Raleigh-Durham area of North Carolina. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
A number of the people we've had on the show have had interesting backgrounds, and you are no exception. You used to play bass in a band called Sparks the Rescue, which may be known to fans of pop punk who are listening. That's quite a start to a career. How did you get into it?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story. It actually happened by chance, just kind of fell into it. I had some friends in high school who used to be into the pop punk scene and used to take me to shows all the time. And when bands would come into town, they'd like a place to crash. It used to happen to be my house. So one of the bands I did was the band I ended up going on the road with. I was just out of high school, went to college for a year or two, didn't know what I was doing, basically majored in partying. It wasn't the greatest fit. So I was back home and trying to figure out what to do with my life. They were about to go on the Vans Warped Tour. This was 2010. And they needed somebody to do merchandise for them. And I happened to say, hey, I got nothing going on. I'd love to come with you. They thought I was cool enough to come with them. Ended up hitting the road. And that was my first tour.
I imagine that's very important these days. I think bands make most of their money on merchandising.
Yeah, quite a bit of it. For us, I think that was probably the bulk of our revenue really from that and the shows themselves for the most part.
So why would you downgrade to being a member of the band?
I know. It paid a lot less, surprisingly.
Hopefully it came with other benefits. What made you decide to move roles within the organization of the band?
That also happened by chance, surprisingly enough. They figured out that I knew how to play guitar. So they set me up playing side stage. So if you guys have ever go to concerts and you see somebody on stage and you have no idea who it is and they're back there playing guitar or piano or anything else and they're not really part of the band, that's basically what I was doing for them. When they would go into a chorus or try to do lead guitar or something, it would be me who would be playing extra rhythm to kind of beef them up and make them sound a little bit better. I knew all their songs at this point, and their bassist decided that he wanted to go back home and just had enough of the road and the road life. I knew all their songs, never picked up a bass in my life, but it was two less strings than guitar, so how hard could it be? So picked it up.
And Les Claypool right now is just crawling out of his skin.
What was it like having the spotlight pointed at you for the first time?
It was super interesting and nerve-wracking and probably everything you would think it would be. It was very different, even from just going side stage or backstage to being front stage. People are really looking at you now. You can't mess this up. So those first couple of shows, I basically just stood there like a statue.
And that is what shirt you're wearing.
Yeah.
Had to work on the stage presence a little bit.
Yeah. And I basically stood there like a statue for that first tour for the first 4 weeks, making sure I hit every note correctly.
Now, your agent provided us a bio, and it said that you've played shows in 46 of the 48 continental United States. Which two did you miss out?
I believe it was North Dakota and Alabama. We've definitely driven through them, but I've never actually played a show there. For the rest of them, yeah, I've been to every single one.
The world of music is a long ways from the world of IT and Kubernetes, but you're at least the third person that we've had onto the show who had a musical background. Do you think there are any skills or talents that you learn from being a part of the music world that are transferable and help you in terms of tech?
I wouldn't say skills. Not a whole lot of it is really transferable. I think probably the biggest insight I can give there is the part of the brain you're using. They're both very creative aspects. As software engineers, you walk in and you're creating something from nothing. You're writing an app or you're inventing some API that didn't exist before you literally sat down and typed it out and wrote it. So it's the same thing with music. You've got something in your head that you like and you need to flesh out. You tap into that same part of the creativity mind that you get into. Some people are just more involved in tech and like it and shift that way. But I think any kind of creative aspect is where musicians tend to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think you can look at programming as being both an art and a science, depending on which way you look at it. There are solutions that are true or false, but then there are also multiple different ways to get to them.
For sure.
So you're on the road with Sparks the Rescue, and obviously that's not your career at the moment. What changed?
Around 2012, a couple of the members decided that they had had enough looking at the band. We weren't making the milestones we were really trying to hit. We were dropped by our label at one point, dropped by our management a month later, then bookings dried up. So it was really tearing off for us. Two of them decided they were going to leave and try to do different endeavors. With that, the last two members live in Maine, and I'm from North Carolina, so it didn't make much sense for me to stick around. So I decided to call it quits as well. I've always been interested in computers. Don't think it was until the last year I was really in the band that I realized that I could do it for a living. It never clicked in my mind before. Even when I went to college before I started being in the band, I was going for a business degree. I didn't even put two and two together quite yet. Throughout that year, I kind of figured out that if I like doing tech stuff, if I like doing IT, basically the tech guy for anybody on the road who's having issues with any of their laptops, as well as running front of house, which is mostly technology-based stuff now anyways, was a natural fit for me to transition from that.
So you went back to school?
Yeah, I went back to community college actually and got an associate's in applied science and information technology. From there, looked around for some jobs during my last year, found an internship at my current company.
What was the first job that you stepped into?
That last year of my degree, I started looking around for jobs and found an internship. I applied to a bunch of places that were hiring interns and actually got a call back from the current company I was at. Ended up getting the job just doing help desk intern stuff. My first task when I got there, we actually switched antivirus providers. So it was literally going around to every single Mac in the building and installing and uninstalling antivirus. The Windows side was a little bit easier because we could do things through group policy, but the Macs, we had no management whatsoever. Through that, I took it upon myself to implement something, anything that could stop me from having to walk to every single laptop in the building and install that kind of stuff.
Laziness is the true sign of the site reliability of the engineer.
This is very true.
So it sounds like early on you were taking some interest in tech and then looked at the fact that automation helps you solve things at scale and looking at how you automated. How did you learn those pieces?
It was really just trying to look out what was in the market. So on the corporate side of things, again, being tasked with kind of walking around and installing antivirus, there's got to be some better way to do this. Looking at projects and open source software and even paid solutions for how to manage software on Macs. Ended up finding a program called Monkey, which is actually open source by Disney, and it's how they manage all of their Macs. So went ahead and set all of that up for our internal company. The last final piece that was still a pain, I had to actually go around and install Monkey itself on every single laptop. But at least after that, I could manage everything remotely and push software out and also have our own internal app store so that people can be more self-serving. So they don't have to put in tickets to get Adobe Acrobat installed. They can get it themselves if they need it.
So it sounds like you've automated yourself out of your first job. How did you move on to the next step?
Luckily, my manager was also the manager for the DevOps team. So we would be in daily standups and go around the room and I would be talking about how I installed antivirus software. And the next guy would talk about how he was moving stuff from Java 8 to Java 11. Most of the terms that were coming out of his mouth were flying over my head. I had no idea what was going on. But luckily, being around that and having those kind of mentors, I slowly started to pick up things that they had been talking about and just got more interested in what it was. When I joined the company, I didn't even have any idea that DevOps was a thing, or that you could even have a job in software, but on the operation sides of things. So just being there with a company that actually had that was super beneficial and really opened my eyes up to the other side of software engineering.
Give us an overview of the software that NetCert builds and runs.
Our company basically takes ads on behalf of companies. So we work a lot with considered purchases, probably the best way we put it. So think of your cars, your furniture, or anything that you're going to research online and really go into a store and buy. That could even be medical services. You need to get liposuction done for some reason.
No judgment.
Things that you're going to research.
Generally high ticket items, it sounds like.
Very high ticket. Again, stuff you're going to buy in the store at the end of the day and not purchase online. We work with those companies to localize all of their ads and run individual campaigns for each of their locations. So think of like Ashley Furniture or BMW and then all of their dealers. We'll take ads in, template ads, and then localize all of them for each of their corporate locations and then push them out to third parties, being AdWords or Facebook or Bing. And then on the inverse side of that, we have the config side. We also have the reporting side where we pull in the data from the previous day every morning, then put it in our reporting dashboard that customers can log into and see how their campaigns are performing.
Now, given that you're talking to us on the Kubernetes podcast, is it fair to assume that there's some Kubernetes in there?
Sure is. About 2 years ago, right before I switched from IT to the DevOps world, they had just finished POCing Kubernetes. When I joined in my first week, it was tasked of all of us to bring up a cluster and actually get a new app into production within the first 2 or 3 weeks that I was there. So I was super fortunate to be joining a team that was just starting to do that. And I didn't get on too late where they had already went through the trials of figuring things out. I got to do that with them, which is super beneficial for me. I'm a very hands-on person, so that's wonderful. All of our stack, we have about 96, 97 microservices, and I think all but 2 or 3 are actually running in Kubernetes. And then all of our pullers right now, again, I mentioned the data that we pull in is running on cron in Kubernetes.
Did you have to learn the art of DevOps at the same time as you're learning Kubernetes? Was that something you picked up by working with colleagues on your new team, or was that something that you were able to study as you made that transition?
It was mostly learned from having those mentors on the team and figuring out what they did and how they did it, working backwards. Learning everything that was going on and then all of a sudden realizing that they were implementing this DevOps methodology and then going back and researching it and looking more at what the discipline defined.
You mentioned that you're doing a bunch of DevOps work, although your current title is SRE. How do those two fit together? And is there an operations team as well, or is it all merged into one role and team within your organization?
For us in our org, we used to have what we called our DevOps team or DevOps engineers. We actually picked up the Google book on SREs and decided that this is probably a better way to view DevOps, the methodology and kind of implementation of it. Try to stop using DevOps as a job title and really make it more of a methodology that you apply to a job. We made that transition, I'd say, 6 months ago. It's relatively new for us, a new step on trying to figure out how all of that fits together. For right now, it's really just the job title that's the implementation of the methodology.
One of the key things about the SRE methodology is the shared responsibility and being able to say to a development team, we're not going to support this until it meets our standards. To do that, you need a certain amount of buy-in from management. How did your team go about getting that buy-in as you moved to SRE?
It was really just making the case for why we need it and how it could benefit them. I think another big thing coming from the music world too is kind of the soft skills that you get from having to deal with different people every day and trying to figure all that out. That really helped transition a little bit better to know that if I'm talking to the VP of product or our CEO himself on how exactly implementing these methodologies is going to benefit the company in a certain way that applies to them directly.
What does a day in the life look like?
My days are pretty sporadic. It could be anything at all. But for the most part, it's usually coming in and looking at tickets that may have come in overnight or any kind of alarms that may have gone off overnight. We actually have a SRE team in Russia that handles the overnight stuff. And we do handoffs in the morning to trade to see if anything happened that I need to be aware of. I'm currently the first line of defense. So if somebody finds an issue with our production systems or a bug or anything like that, I'll at least first go in and see if it's an actual bug or if it's just user error and they're just not using the system right before I'll hand it off to our development team to take a closer look to figure out what's going on. Or if it's something that I might be able to do myself and not have to bother a team to take them off of something, I'll do that as well.
Send in the red shirts.
Yeah, exactly. The other half of it is project work, whether that be moving things into Kubernetes, or right now we're currently looking at trying to move all of our pullers out of cron and more time-based to more data-driven, so that you start it up in the morning and we don't have to wait 4 hours for our automation to kick in because we're waiting on these pullers to technically be done when they could be finished in 30 minutes instead of 4 hours, because you're actually depending on something that's been finished for a while and you're not just waiting on time for time's sake.
One of the components of SRE that's talked about in the book is that people spend a certain amount of their time doing coding and automation and not just the running of the operations pieces of it. Is there a development component to the job that you do?
For sure. It really just depends on the project and what we're working on and where it fits in. Some of the stuff that we do, there may be some open source software that's already out there that I don't really need to dive into, but there are certainly parts that we have to end up coding ourselves. Really, anything that's going to make my life easier is what I tend to gravitate towards. Most recently, we're doing Kubernetes upgrades in Amazon with EKS. We're still using our own self-managed nodes. They've come a long ways having EKS Cuddle that helps out a lot with doing those kind of upgrades. But for us, because we started right when they started their managed service offering, our setup is still quite different than how they're doing it today. I've actually written some automation in Go that'll do those upgrades for me. So I don't have to spend the 3 or 4 hours clicking through the Amazon UI to set up new auto-scaling groups and new security groups and IAM roles and EFS provisioning and all that kind of mundane things.
I understand that EKS wasn't the first Kubernetes platform that you used. When you adopted Kubernetes, what platform was it originally running on?
We started doing this POC and migrating to Kates, say 2018. During that time, Amazon didn't have a managed offering whatsoever. I think Google, you guys were the only ones who had an offering at the time. And we actually debated whether to hook up our complete AWS stack with Google just to get the Kubernetes option. We ended up deciding to go with Rancher, which was great at the time. You didn't have to know entirely too much about the system, but you still had to manage the control plane yourself, which again was super beneficial for me and I think the rest of the team to understand how all those pieces fit together. And if something goes wrong, you can still go in and figure out what exactly is happening. We did a lot of chaos engineering at the first outset of all of that to have somebody go in and run a bash script that just overloads one of the control nodes to see if we could figure out what entirely is going on and where the issue was to begin with.
When Amazon bought their managed service out, you migrated off Rancher. What were the challenges and how did you go about that migration?
That migration was pretty interesting. During the time, we used Heptio's service, Arc, I believe is what it was called then. I believe they got bought out by VMware and it's now called Valero. But we use that to actually back up all of our clusters, which is a really great offering, especially with Kates being so ephemeral. You're not actually saving EC2 instances anymore. You're just dumping a bunch of YAML into a zip file, and that's your backup. So we use that to stand up new clusters in EKS and migrate everything over. Everything was great for about the first 4 days. On day 5, we started noticing some issues with Arc itself trying to start up. Then also our autoscaler just started kicking itself over and over, and we weren't entirely sure what was going on. Opened up some support cases with Amazon. They weren't entirely sure what was happening either. A couple days later, I slowly started to dive into what was happening, and you could see some errors about one of the Kubernetes APIs not having any information about it. So it said it existed, but if you actually looked for it, it told you it didn't exist. What had happened is Arc had actually restored one of those beta APIs that was enabled in Rancher, but not enabled in EKS, but it didn't have any information about it. So it made it look like it existed, but it didn't actually exist. When any of those applications started up and tried to use discovery against the Kates API to figure out what exactly is in the cluster, it would hit that certain point and then just fail out because it said it existed, but it didn't actually exist.
You could almost consider that a bug in Arc that it let that happen. Did you follow up with them? And how did you go about resolving that, not only for yourself, but for the community?
I did. At the time, I didn't know too much Go. So I did open a ticket and let them know what was happening. I believe they ended up fixing it and trying to avoid restoring the Kubernetes APIs themselves, but any kind of custom resource definitions they would, of course, do. I believe they stopped doing it from there. I did report it back to them. I believe they fixed it. But at the time, didn't know too much Go, so didn't dive too much into it. I think today I probably would have taken upon myself to probably implement a fix and commit it back to the repo and help out the community.
So the move from Rancher to EKS, was that motivated solely by having someone manage the service on your behalf?
100%. The 30 cents an hour that it cost for them to manage it for us was super beneficial for us, so we didn't have to take up so much of our time to manage those things ourselves. for the clusters that we have and the things we're doing, we don't need too many highly specialized things that we need to manage ourselves or enable certain things that aren't enabled in EKS. So for us, it was a huge relief burden that we could get off of ourselves to not have to manage that control plane anymore.
As Kubernetes becomes a commodity provided by cloud providers, how do you think vendors like Rancher, who started off making it easy to install these things, but now aren't necessarily valuable to you, how do you think they can remain relevant?
I think they still are relevant. I think even today, they've made some changes to highlight Kubernetes as their main thing. Bare metal installs are still huge all around the country and the world, really. Some people just aren't using cloud yet. To stand that up in your data center, Rancher is a great option to do that.
In terms of your own deployment and following of SRE and DevOps principles and practices, is everything automated or are there still a lot of manual tasks to be done?
I will say it's mostly automated. I wish it was 100% automated. There is still some kind of push button things. But since the time that I started in the role and to where we are now is almost night and day. It's almost a completely different engineering department. We used to have bi-weekly deploys where we'd actually have to take all of our applications offline, have a scheduled maintenance where we'd send out email to customers to say, hey, you can't access it for an hour while we're upgrading everything. So now you can deploy anytime, anywhere with a big help from Kubernetes to get us there. But also that using GitOps as well. As soon as you merge something to develop, it's in our pre-production environment and our automation kicks off and you do your testing as you need to. The only last step that we have that still has to be done manually is the deployment to production. Still trying to convince my bosses that it's a good idea for us to automate that. We'll see how that goes.
Still some wariness about fully automating the ability to push things into production in case something goes wrong. The safety valve essentially is that a human still has to make that call.
Yep. But the good part about it too is keeping in line with that SRE methodology is we've given our developers a whole lot of tools that they can use themselves. So it's not me that has to deploy to production. It's really anybody can do it. The team that's actually working on the app, as long as they've deemed it worthy and tested and everything's good, they can deploy it themselves. They don't need me as the gatekeeper to do it for them.
Have you gone full on cattle versus pets in terms of have you shut off all RDP and SSH to all the servers and any fixes go through a redeployment versus a go in and make changes?
For the most part, I think now that, again, once we have most of our applications running in Kubernetes with the use of Helm as well, it's a lot easier to just run a Helm rollback than it is to go in and try to figure out what's going on. We still have some kind of legacy services and APIs that are still running on old EC2 instances that we're hoping to move into Kates or just shut off completely, hopefully by the end of next year.
You've mentioned a few different methodologies there with GitOps and also with Helm. How do you evaluate the tools out there for this kind of development deployment on top of Kubernetes? And how do you decide what you will support and offer to your developers?
For us, it's really just what's going to fit our needs and what the company wants to do. We're very open to new technologies. If anybody has a passion about something or wants to try something new, we're super open about it. For us, it's really just trying to find something that's going to fit our needs. For us, it was really, we need to deploy stuff to Kubernetes. What's the best way to do that? We have 4 different environments, and how do we get each one of these different? Do we end up using something like Customize, or what was the old one that used to be Qson, I believe, at the time? I think we investigated that as well. Or Helm, and Helm seemed like the best option for us. Right now, we have just a repo of blanket Helm templates that we use, and then each one of our applications stores its own values file and then ends up doing the deploys that way.
You've mentioned Helm a couple of times, and not only do you use it, but you're also a contributor to the project now, correct?
Yes.
What inspired you to contribute to Helm?
The biggest thing for me to get involved with that was we had a bug that we needed to fix. Most things that I end up contributing to is just stuff that I find that I need to fix for my company. I'm sure other people as well. From the migration from Helm 2 to Helm 3, there's a flag that you can set. It's called reuse values. We use that a lot in our pre-production environment to where we have basically a super chart, which is a giant Helm chart made up of all of our microservices, their Helm charts as well. We use that flag to actually deploy to the environment to stand it up. And then after that, make changes to individual applications. So we leave that flag on all the time. What was happening is if you did it the first time and you weren't using any values beforehand, it wouldn't deploy anything at all. It would just ignore that flag and completely break. Going in and making that fix to make it work like it did in Helm 2 again was what I contributed.
2 years into your Kubernetes journey, how have you seen the technology change? And how do you think it would be different for someone getting started today from when you did it?
Luckily with Kates, it's super backwards compatible. So a lot of the stuff that we're doing now is still relevant today. There's a lot of new features you can take advantage of, but the stuff that we were doing then almost applies directly today. It has changed quite a bit. There's definitely a lot of new features you can get involved in. and lots of things that may be applicable for your company or may not. It's a bigger landscape than it's ever been.
There are a number of people who unfortunately aren't able to keep up with their previous career, especially in the arts. Touring musicians, obviously a big part of that. If there are people who are interested in retraining today, getting involved in IT or working their way into an SRE kind of career, what advice would you give them?
I think the biggest thing is really just don't be afraid to do it. Look around, try things. If you're interested in it, give it a shot. Today, especially with Kubernetes itself, 2 years ago, it was difficult to get started. You had Minikube, and I think that was probably about it to get something running on your own laptop. Today, there's 4 or 5 different options that you can get up and running. Docker for Mac has a built-in Kubernetes cluster that you can start. You can also run Kind, have a cluster up in 2 seconds to do that kind of stuff. For me, I think the biggest thing is just hands-on work. Some people learn a little bit differently, but for me, it's really just diving in with a new technology and self-training.
Finally, for fun, you obviously used to play in a band, know lots of people and things in the music scene. What is one band you think is underappreciated that people might want to check out but don't know about?
That's a tough one. There's quite a few. I'll try to stick to the pop-punk realm. One of the newer bands that's come out is called Hot Mulligan. Very strange name. They have very, very strange song titles as well. Very solid band. I believe they're out of Seattle. Don't quote me on that, though. Super good.
Lansing, Michigan.
Completely wrong.
Yeah, they're both northern border states, right?
That's close enough, right? They're basically next to each other.
Do you have any stories from the road? Do you have any tales of bands who you think, oh, hey, they'll be out there drinking hard, but you go backstage and they're actually drinking a cup of tea or something like that?
Yeah, you'd be surprised at how many of your favorite death metal bands actually love Taylor Swift and listen to pop music 24/7. I'm the exception to that rule where I actually really enjoy pop punk music and I also played it. For the most part, your favorite musicians and whatever they play, they probably don't listen to that as well. One tour we were on, we had a death screamo band that went on every night and screamed their lungs out. And then you'd see him a half hour later standing front row for our set, singing along with the words and just absolutely loved our band. You find it quite a lot, actually.
It's awesome.
I think music people just love music.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You can find David Pate on Twitter at SparksTheDave.
That's it.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed this show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod, reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com, or fill out our survey at KubernetesPodcast.com/survey.
You can find other things at our website, including transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. Until next time, take care.
Catch you next week.